Good morning. Now that we have a quorum, I'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session, May City Council, for Thursday, June 28th, 2012. I guess we'd like to excuse Council Members Higgins and Richens and the Vice Mayor, who are not here. And unless one's on the phone right now, the Vice Mayor and Councilmember Higgins were going to try and join us by phone. The first item on the agenda is to go over the agenda for next Monday night's regular council meeting. Page 2, item 3A. Items 3B through 3D. Items 3E through 3G. Items 3H through 4A. Items 4B through 4G. Items 5A through 6E. Okay, and we're going to hear a presentation on we don't have that on. You didn't put that on yet. We're going to wait to see if we have that the things we're going to talk about this morning. Okay. All right. Okay. Then we'll go on to the next item, which is to hear a presentation, discuss, provide direction on the La Mesita development. Mr. Boucher.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Scott Boucher, Acting Assistant to the City Manager, here today to give you an update on the La Mesita project. Just to remind everybody, this is one of the low-income housing tax credit projects. What we're going to go over today is some of the timelines that are associated with this project. These timelines are mandated by the state of Arizona through their process. By July 16th, they have to have evidence of site ownership. This is different from the other properties that we've talked about, the other projects that we've talked about, because La Mesita does currently own the property. So they have that taken care of, except for one small restriction that's associated with the property that I'll talk about in a little bit. By October 18th, they need to have their draft equity closing documents are due. So we will be coming back to the council later on after break with those documents associated with that. And then by November 1st, they have to begin construction. These are the documents that I'll be talking about today. Release of a deed restriction, the development agreement, loan agreement, and also a purchase and sale agreement that is for a property at Power in Monterey that this project is not dependent on, but it's an opportunity that arose through our discussions with a new LEAF. So we're coming to council today to seek some direction in regards to that. The deed restriction. What's going on with the property is in 1991, the city acquired the property using CDBG funds. And then in 2008, the property was transferred to a new LEAF. As part of that property transfer, and this is why a new LEAF currently has property ownership, as part of that agreement, their subrecipient agreement, they were required to have 5 years of continued use as a shelter for homeless families. The way that we ensure that's happening is we have a deed restriction that's placed on the property. That makes them have that use. And the agreement does, though, allow for a release of this deed restriction within that 5 years. The way that the deed restriction can be released is if it's within 5 years, the city's reimbursed for the current market value of the property, less any value attributable to the expenditures of non-CDBG funds for the acquisition or improvements of the property. We've had a third party take a look at the property, and its current market value is $600,000. We were working with a new LEAF to try and determine that value attributable to the improvements that they've made to the property since 2008. But because of those tight timelines from the state of Arizona, a new LEAF has chosen to just purchase the deed restriction from the property for the $600,000. So just to let council know, though, that that CDBG, that $600,000 will be considered CDBG program income. So it goes back into the CDBG program. And in our annual plan this year with CDBG, we do have it that any unallocated funds in the CDBG program will go back to La Mesita for another project that they're doing for a shelter and a MAC. So the money will come in as program income, but then it's already in the annual plan, and this was done before we anticipated this even happening, that it would go back to La Mesita for a shelter that they're building in the back. This needs to be completed before July 16th so that they have complete control of that site so they can meet those state requirements. Now, the development agreement that we have, that we're working on, again, we will be back to council after the break with the development agreement and the loan agreement to meet that October deadline. In the development agreement, kind of the key points are that La Mesita has to meet all the requirements associated with the Department of Housing. The city will have a process for them that they will go through for the possibility of getting 30 project-based housing vouchers for the property, and that the city will be loaning them $500,000. Again, this needs to be done before October 18th. The loan document that we'll be coming back to you with at that same time details out that $500,000 loan. It's a 20-year, 0% interest loan with a full payment, in essence a balloon payment that will be due at the end of that 20-year term. In addition to that, as I said, we had an opportunity that arose through discussions with a new lease for a property at Power in Monterey. This is a property located directly adjacent to Monterey Park out in East Mesa, approximately Power and Guadalupe. City's looking at purchasing that property. Its appraised value is $975,000. We're looking at purchasing it for $1 million, and we're hoping to close on that property in July. So, and again, this is not dependent upon the deal associated with the La Mesita property.
Hey, Scott, going back to the aerial on that, what's that out parcel on the that's a well?
Right.
Yeah, the northeast part, north corner. That's where I thought. Okay. So we already own that. Okay.
And with that, I'll take any questions that you may have.
Has anything changed in these basic terms? And I'm a little fuzzy because we had the three projects coming through, and they all seem to melt together. What's changed since the initial presentation a couple, 3 months ago?
The only thing that changed, we knew that we had to deal with the deed restriction. What we didn't know when we were here previously is how we were going to deal with that deed restriction. There were many options presented by HUD to us, but the only option that would meet the timelines from the state of Arizona was this, where they purchased the deed restriction for the current market value. That was really the only thing that has changed. We knew that there was a deed restriction associated
with the property.
Was the loan
in there also?
Yes, the loan was in there. And Scott, if correct me if I'm wrong, but the very, very beginning, the loan amount was $1.5 million.
The loan amount was $1.5 million in the
beginning. And we've kind of dealt with that by agreeing to this. It's separate, but agreeing to this purchase,
okay,
which creates cash for them through their nonprofit foundation.
Well, let's. Yes, it does create cash for them, but let's complete that loop. We've been looking at Monterey Park for quite a while.
Well, actually, this was part of our proposal and our
long
loan
before,
program.
Well, and long before a new lease became involved.
Absolutely.
In this particular project, we'd looked at Monterey Park because we have huge issues out there with a park that is really
needs more
under
space.
Capacity. When I say overused, that doesn't sound right. But parking issues, huge parking issues. Huge capacity issues because it's a very, very popular park. So we were already looking for land in that area. So this is really
it worked out really well.
Almost a gift that we found that a new Leaf owned that property. We can take care of two things with one fell swoop. Is that accurate?
Right. So when New Leaf came to us about the $1.5 million, city staff went back to them and said, you know, we've been looking at this property that's adjacent to Monterey. We've had these issues. And then we were able to come to terms on that purchase.
And it just happened that it killed two birds with one stone.
Yes, it did.
Okay.
Mayor.
Oh, Vice Mayor. Hello.
Yeah, I've been spying. I'd also add that it wasn't I-MACE, or identified on I-MACE, the right. park that residents wanted to see expanded to serve more regional need.
Okay. And I think, Councilmember Higgins, you still on?
Yes, Mayor.
Okay.
I am still here.
Great. Thank you. All righty. Are there any other questions for Scott on this program? Okay, we okay to have the staff move ahead? I see nods here. Vice Mayor, Council Member Higgins, you okay with the staff moving ahead?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the next item is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the draft community plan for the Pacific Proving Grounds North.
Get this pulled up.
Does say draft. Does say daft. Mr. Wesley.
Mayor and Council, I'm here with Angelica Guevara, who is the senior planner in our office. It's the planner in charge of this particular application. I'll make the presentation. She's here to correct all the things that I mess up as we go along.
Ooh.
I know, she'll be busy.
You guys are going to say she's going to be really busy.
Sometime in August or September, after you've come back from your break, you should find on your agenda a request for annexation, development agreement, comparable zoning, and then rezoning to the planned community district for this property. So this is an early opportunity we have to begin to brief council on this. We know that you've just recently received the latest version of this document, and we don't expect you to, you know, have been familiar with. We're not asking for any significant feedback or action today, just an opportunity for us to brief you on it. We'll be moving forward to the P&Z board to get their recommendation soon. We're starting our final review, and so we're just wanting to touch base with the council and see if you do have any comments or feedback for us and applicants at this time that we might include as we're doing this final review. So today we are going to provide you with an overview of the proposed plan, hitting on some of the key items, and again, looking for any initial feedback you may have for us. This illustrates the location of the property. It's just under 500 acres, just north of the future State Route 24 extension, and it's part of the former GM Proving Grounds property. As we've been working with the applicant and looking at this property, we've got several things that we're using as our policy direction in developing this plan. First, the general plan, the Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan, the project narrative that went with the last general plan update, or the major general plan amendment for this property by Pacific Proving, and then the requirements from the planned community district ordinance. So I'm going to comment on a couple of those things here quickly just to give us that background context. The Gateway Strategic Development Plan, as you know, calls for mixed-use type developments, an open space system, looking for opportunities to create sustainable development practices in the area, and suggested developing and using a form-based approach in the area. This particular piece of the overall gateway area is in the what we call the mixed-use community area. It's the area east of the 202 and north of the future 24. It's the area that we envision being the most mixed, the best location for residential uses to occur. In this area, the emphasis was on the kind of that work-play communities that could be created and having a series of urban cores and creating walkable areas. The plan also includes some design ideas for how we might achieve this, and I just put a couple of them in here. There are several that are in the book, but again, we're looking at these as we're talking to Pacific Proving and looking at what the options are for development of their property.
So basically, it looks like we're taking a very similar approach to what we took to the north there in
DMB piece.
Yeah, Mesa Proving Grounds, now Eastmark.
That's correct, Mayor, because they're both in that same.
As far as design standards and the same approach with the graphical representation, those kind of things.
Yes.
Okay.
As far as the Pacific Proving and their major plan amendment and their project narrative, it included this graphic that while this is a concept of how the property may be laid out and it's not a specific requirement that it end up exactly this way, it gives us some idea what they were looking for and what we were agreeing to at the time. Starts with an urban core up here in the northeast piece and some community commercial, and then medium residential and mixed-use high-density residential and a suburban core and suburban commercial down in the southern end. So this piece right now that we're talking about in terms of the current community plan. As we look at the document and continue on, you'll see that they're no longer looking at this regional commercial as part of this development. And the mixed use and high intensity has really shifted mostly up to the northwest And most of this is being looked at as the medium-density residential-type development.
And this this guidance document, this conforms with agreements that were made actually before this council took office, but back in, what, 2006, 2007?
Correct.
As far as placement of residential, the division line being the alignment of the 24 and the basic uses?
Yes. Okay. And we'll see that as we go on and look at their actual development units and their land use budget. They're conforming to that.
Okay.
So they had a proposal or a projection on the non-residential development that could occur within here, and then focusing particularly on the community and regional commercial areas that were in their previous plan, and the square footages and job creation they were expecting at that time. They were considering almost 2 million square feet of non-residential space in that community and regional commercial areas. The community commercial includes some areas outside of what we're talking about today, so it's a little bit larger area that those would have been in. But again, that gives us some basis to look at what they're proposing today. Their plan also included some vision statements about the employment and retail that would be used in supporting the residential development of that suburban core. It would develop the pedestrian friendly streets and trails and use traditional residential development opportunities. You know, the final document we've been using as our background and reference is the planning community ordinance itself and some of the objectives that we're trying to create with that. The goals here are a little bit different than your traditional planned community, planned area development type community, where master plan community, where everything's really built at once and you expect it to stay the same. We're looking at that evolving community that will happen over time and getting some assurances up front that what the council approves up front can then be implemented over time through the other stages of development.
Can I go back to your last slide and that last bullet point, which says traditional residential opportunities? Could you expand on that just a little bit? What exactly does that mean?
Mayor, this is a statement that was pulled from their project narrative, and you know, I don't have that document in front of me to remember any more specifically what that might have gone on to say. But my idea of what it is going to be, you know, the single-family house on the individual lot is going to be a large part of what they're looking at. But again, as you'll see as we go on, they've taken that and they're looking at not your really typical suburban-type residential development. They've brought those lot sizes down, look at more of the community amenities and those types of things.
Yeah, because I'm, you know, and this is the first big housing we've had since we really put in, well, since Mesa Proving Ground. And that was in sort of in process and did that right after we did the Gateway Area Plan. But I'm a little concerned isn't the right word. We talk about suburban core and traditional residential opportunities, and I just want to make sure that we recognize we're a mile from an airport.
Right.
Now, granted, we're not in the flight path. This is outside the areas that were designated as flight corridors, so we know that. But I still want to be real, real careful that we don't morph back into a suburban, edge-of-the-city kind of approach when the realities are when you're a mile from the airport, those two have a tendency to create conflict.
Absolutely, Mayor. And I think you'll see that they've responded to that as we go on through the presentation, look at what they're proposing.
Okay.
But it is an important issue that we're looking at, too, as we do this. So, again, the planning community district, again, some of those statements in it that we've looked at. The last one, assurance to the city that the plan will be implemented is an important part of that. So with that kind of background, we'll look at the plan itself and the document that we've been reviewing. These are the chapters that you'll see in the total document. Angelica's got one version of it here, several hundred pages have been working on. Today we're going to focus primarily on the regulatory framework, their community vision, and the residential and commercial land use groups, because those really form the heart of what they're doing. The regulatory framework that's being proposed is very similar to what we did see in the previous community plan for DMB. The first phase is this community plan, which sets the overall budget and vision and development standards for the document or for the development. Does the infrastructure master plans, those types of things. This is the one item that comes to council for approval. You set the zoning, you set the overall plan for the area. After that, we'll go through development unit plan processes and site plan processes that actually lead to being able to develop an individual piece of property. Those will go through the Planning and Zoning Board and staff for approval and not come back to council as it's currently proposed. Largely, they're using our existing zoning ordinance and modifying it to create their plan. So it's been easy to work on from that regard. We've got a standard to work from. They've also had the opportunity to look at and propose modifications to engineering standards. At this point, they really are doing very little modifications at this point. We've had some discussions about the widths of right-of-ways and right-of-ways backed by PUFEs, and been learning from our experience with DMB about maybe some better ways to do that we're working with them on. When I prepared this, we're having some discussions about the master developer, Harvard Investments. Does not plan to long-term be that master developer. At some point when they have sold all their property, they want to exit. The plan we've been looking at to divide that up into several kind of entities that would be that overall master developer. In our discussions with them yesterday, we agreed that really doesn't work and does not meet the intent of the ordinance, and so they're going to be reworking that section, so there will still be a master developer that will oversee the project long-term.
And I appreciate that, because I can just see if it's split up too much, then next thing we have is a lineup of new developers coming in wanting to change the plan because it doesn't fit their specific needs, and I think we need to do whatever we can to avoid that. I think we're given a lot of leeway and a lot of flexibility. That's the approach, but there has to be a consistency and a commitment that plan will be followed, and anyone who comes in after the fact needs to understand that's going to be set in stone. I mean, we're not going to create a quilt, a patchwork of change, and I can just see that happening where someone comes in 3-4 years from now, especially with a new council, and now wants to change what was put in place. And I think that the beauty of what we've done out there is to create flexibility, but on the other hand, there's a real commitment once we arrive at that framework, that there's a commitment that's how the property will be developed, unless of course there's major changes in how the whole area develops. But that's got to be a pretty high standard in my mind.
That's right. And any of those changes that are major like that do come back to the council for approval.
Okay.
And so then looking a little closer here with their development units, they're proposing to divide this area up into 5 development units. DU1 in the northwest corner is the one that has the potential to be the most mixed use, most urban of the developments. DUs 2 and 4 will be primarily residential, with a mix of single and could be some multi-residential and some commercial opportunities down at the Crisman and Williamsfield intersection. The 2 DUs south of Williamsfield, 3 and 5, are both staying commercial employment type of development units. There's no residential in those. We have a little closer look at the budget that's attached there. There's actually a slight revision to this that we received yesterday, but you can see how they're proposing to divide things up through the different development units and their minimum maximum development potential that's being established. In the DU1, one of the concerns that we have had is that if you look there on the right-hand column, they could have 95% of that DU in residential. And that, again, is a place we're looking at the opportunity for some type of urban core and some employment needs in the area. They've amended that in the most recent version to have that topped out at 75% on the non-residential, or on the residential, which leaves us at least 25% that will be non-residential, so that helps with that. They've also upped both the minimum and the maximum amount of non-residential for that. Now, the new minimum is $125,000 of non-residential, up to $400,000 of non-residential.
Hey, question.
Mayor.
Excuse me, Mayor.
Yeah, Vice Mayor and then Dina.
Mayor, on the DMB agreement, I remember we had some questions on or some job goals. This is a smaller piece of property, but I wonder if we can't look at taking a look at that particular urban core area and setting some objectives for jobs there.
Mayor, Vice Mayor, we can certainly go back and look at that. As we saw on their general plan amendment, we did convert the square footages into some job numbers. We haven't talked about that specifically here. We did have a meeting a few weeks ago with Economic Development where they did discuss these numbers and felt like they were a little low and did have some job numbers that they were interested in seeing in this area. So we can continue to work with that and see if that's a factor we can add into this particular area.
Yeah, and the one question I have is, or the observation I have is, remember, this is a small parcel of the whole Pacific Peruvian. We got the whole area to the south of the freeway, which is primarily
employment.
Correct. Employment.
So I agree with you, Mayor. Okay. But we have to remember too that this the portion up against Ellsworth Road is going to be directly across from the airport, and we want to make sure that we can tie those two pieces together seamlessly as much as possible. I think setting some objectives is fine. We don't have to get too prescriptive.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins?
I had the same question, Mayor. I just wanted to make sure that this development was meeting our goals for job creation. So you already answered that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. And we will we'll work with that with them on that. When we look at DU2, you can see that it, again, is, has the opportunity to be primarily the single residence and small lot single residence. We'll talk about a little bit more in a minute, development. There's been some concerns. We'll talk about this with the Planning and Zoning Board. The way this is structured, 95% of DU2 could be in the small lot single residence, which can be lots of 4,500 square feet and smaller. And there's been some concern that, that we could get too much of one type with this flexibility that, that's been granted here. We are working on some language for other parts of the code that do two things. One that says there will be some variety in lot sizes so we don't end up with all one, but still leaving that flexible for the market to create over time. And then also some references to design standards to make sure that if we, where we have those lots, that, that there is some variety in the setbacks and how those come together. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute.
But well, I'll tell you what I'm concerned. Oh, yeah. Vice Mayor, go ahead.
Just on that point, John, what's the typical size of a lot in, say, the Willow District in downtown Phoenix?
Vice Mayor, I've not looked at that yet. I know there's been a lot of discussion about the Willow District and it being an example, and I can take a look at that, but I haven't at this point.
I think those are,
okay.
Looking at those are probably 45, 50 wides. Probably
right.
4,500, 5,000 feet max. I think they're 100 feet deep.
Yeah, I just, in talking to Harvard and others, that the idea here is to make sure that we have a bit of the density and the urban feel that would be appropriate here. So I don't want to inadvertently turn this into a suburban sprawl red tile roof development.
Well,
so I'm okay with some density within reason.
And to piggyback onto what the Vice Mayor said, I think that the real telling here is that it the density doesn't bother me. We're by an airport. We our plan is to create an urban core around an airport. I'm not so much worried about density as much as I am as the makeup, because I think if we have a cluster of 300 acres, 270 acres of houses with nothing but houses, that's a suburban, that's just a high density suburban neighborhood. I think if you look at 300 acres, that's a half section, almost. And in an urban development, you have an intermingled in that small commercial, small little neighborhood walking distance kind of a thing. Because if you're looking almost a half a mile from one end to the other and have nothing but houses, that doesn't create an urban type feel. So I hope that we have the ability to go in and let's say if it does develop to where it's all high density, then in the middle you can put a little neighborhood market or a little service thing with maybe a barber shop, a beauty parlor, something like that, that breaks it up and creates a more walking feel. Is that possible in this, or are we on these dwelling units, have we now created a conflict in which we say we want an urban style development and yet the rules we have do the same thing that our suburban does, which is pushes all commercial to the edges, which means it's nothing more than a suburban subdivision with a different title on it.
Mayor, there is the opportunity here for that. As you look again in DU2, the CC is the community commercial and the CMU is the mixed use commercial designation. So 10% of this area, up to 30% of this total area can
be. I would like to see as that goes forward that be pushed toward the middle of this area rather than left on the side. Because that's what we see now, where you have the community commercial, the local residential or the commercial that's pushed to the arterials, and that's what we do now.
Right.
I would like to see it pushed more toward the middle or, adjacent to our open areas, things like that create, if we're going to say this is an urban type of approach, that we really truly make it that type of approach, and that's where you see it. If you look in the old neighborhoods, you'll see the little commercial pockets inside the residential.
we just wanted to point out that even within their land use, residential land use group, they have allowed for some non-residential land uses to occur within DUs 2 and 4.
Well, I appreciate the allowing. I would like us to strongly suggest and even do what we can to incentivize through whatever that we really have this commercial. Because that's a new way of looking at things. That's not your traditional way. That's the way that if you look at the Willows, if you look at places like that, that's the way things used to grow organically. And we've gotten away from that because we, once again, even with form-based code and whatever, we still put specific parcels, and they tend to be on arterials and things so people can drive to them. And I don't think that that's what we're envisioning here. And I'm not saying force or whatever, but we need to have that mix and make it look like and evolve more into a more urban type thing where people literally can walk.
Absolutely, Mayor. We've talked with them about this point several times, and I think probably there's still some room for improvement as we work on it. But the idea that it can evolve, that right now they might not envision certain uses happening within the residential districts, and they might not want to implement that up front, but let's have the tools in there so that as it evolves over time,
and I don't mind if we state it as an aspiration and say it's our objective that we have this. And I know things will develop as they develop, but if you don't say it's an aspiration and that's what you're looking for and it's not just there in bold letters almost, things will go, you know, development flows like water into the path of least resistance. And the easiest one is just to carve out 2 acres right there on the corner of Main and Center and say, oh, okay, this is our strip center. And if we do that I think both of us have failed. Councilmember Fender.
I was going to say I had a chance to visit some friends out in Verado in the West Valley, and I was able to take what I think I'm hearing, some of these concepts, and be able to see it in action and how the neighborhoods work with these small commercial centers. And so it was a great example to me of some positive things that have been done along these lines. So I hope maybe that's an example we could use.
Okay, thank you. As we look at the bottom of this table, again, it's been updated a little bit. The minimum total non-resident square footage they're saying now is 400,000 square feet and up to 1.35 million. If we look back at their chart before and what they were proposing for non-residential, this is maybe still just a little bit low. It's something we'll continue to discuss with them and see if there's opportunities there. So that was the regulatory piece, looking at what they've put in their document with regard to the vision, talking about a new traditional community, relying on some smart growth principles and traditional neighborhood type design, such as the Willow neighborhoods, the type of thing that we've looked at, those walkable neighborhoods with the dynamic streets. Then the planning framework within this vision is based around neighborhoods, streets, parks, and their architecture. And we have some examples here. This particular map we've used to kind of summarize some of those concepts that they have been talking about. You can see that they will create sub-neighborhood areas throughout the overall development. They've got a street system that relies heavily on this collector street through there, and then numerous connections to that. That also has a pedestrian system that goes with it. For some scale, this distance between these two cul-de-sacs is about a quarter mile. It's about a half mile long here. You can see their trail system and also paseo along the freeway side, and numerous parks and open spaces, potential school site, the main community center to the northeast corner, and these are throughout the area. These circles represent 300-foot radius or 600-foot diameter. So you can see that any resident, any house within these areas is no more than 300 feet from some type of open space or park. So they have those connections spread throughout. So I recall the number, they have about 65 acres of parks and open space within this, and I believe it's 8 miles of streets and trail systems for the public to be able to get around and get to these sites. As we talked about just a minute ago, and you'll see as we go on to the commercial or the residential districts, they are looking at a lot of small lots where that you don't have a lot of your own yard space. The emphasis is on the community spaces and getting people to the community parks and those areas. And so they'll spread those out and have that system throughout here, again, trying to balance those needs of the area. And this illustrates some of the architectural concepts they have for the area, simple architectural forms that they plan to use in this area. And then another key component of the community vision has been the idea of integration and connectivity. again, trying to get away from the typical suburban model where things are separated from each other by walls. We want to see things that are integrated with each other. You flow from one to the other. Phrase we've been using a lot is seamless transitions, so that you can move from one part of the development to the other. Fewer walls.
Can I amend that? I would like to see no walls between uses. I think when you talk about fewer walls, once again, you're gonna err back in the same thing. I mean, Councilman Fender talked about one. I spent half a lifetime going through cutting edge communities like Celebration and other things like that. And you know, old cities, towns, the Wills had no walls between uses. You naturally flowed from one use to another. You had multifamily next across from estate lots next to high density and with a pocket commercial area and an open space. And it all flowed together because that's what a community was. And it wasn't until we went into the Euclidean kind of zoning where we all of a sudden stuck these walls up. I'd like to have as a goal that we have virtually no walls, because I think that forces the development community to be creative. If we don't do this, and I've tried to do this, you get your apartment developer who doesn't want to be I'll tell you, there's no apartment developer around that wants to interact with a single-family residential area, and they'll put as big a wall as they want. I fought that battle with apartment developers for years. I think as a goal, we need to say, listen, if you're going to plan it, we want your multifamily, we want this, we want them to flow. We want them to be part of the same community, not with a 6-foot wall with 2 feet of wrought iron on top of that completely separates, and you have a car entry to one end, and there's absolutely no interaction between the two. Maybe I'm a little bit idealistic on this, but we have an opportunity to do something which should be easy. This just should not be difficult, but it does break the norm. It does go against the normal process that that we've used here in certainly in the Phoenix area for now 2-3 decades. So that's my editorial comment.
And Mayor, as we look back at this particular map and the use of the Collector Street through here, you know, we think there's an opportunity to have local streets that get started coming off of here that go ahead and integrate these neighborhoods rather than doing what you say the traditional has been, where you come around on the Collector and get into the individual neighborhoods and don't have as immediate a flow. And that's one of the things we'll look at. Some of this we'll really have to deal with more specifically when we get to development unit plans. We're not going to see it at this level, but we need to make sure the tools
are
in place.
But I think talking about it now and saying what our aspirations are, I get it that you know, I'd rather shoot high and then, you know, if reality sets in and we can't accomplish all those things, at least we've elevated it rather than say here, because that's where we're going to end up if that's where we set the target. We're going to end up where our target is. I'd rather shoot high because I think it's the thing that commercially is viable. I think it makes for a better community. I think it's, you know, everyone can win in this if we just raise the standards. I look at this is a great plan, the community vision. But on the other hand, if you look at it, once again, where have you pushed your commercial areas? To the edges, to the intersections. Where, you know, and even though we can say, yeah, it allows for things in the middle, maybe we can say, hey, listen, we'd love to see a little bit of commercial sitting there next to your community center. You know, why can't someone go there and while their kids are doing it, they go across the street and get a haircut or do something like that? I would, you know, where is the multifamily going to come in here? And as we go forward with this thing, I'd like to really push the edge and see if we can create something that's a little different, special, because I think it can be, I know it can be commercially viable because I've seen it work like Councilman Fenter has in a lot of other places, and I've been through some great communities that people love to live in. The developers make good money. They're rewarded for their investment and the risk, and the community is much better off.
Okay.
That's my second editorial comment. I'm sorry. I've passed my quota. Apologize.
We're going to move there from the vision to some of the more specifics here in terms of the residential land use groups. They're within the residential. They're proposing three categories. The first one, the CR, community residential, is your standard single-family lot. Then the small lot, single-family, and then the multifamily residential. They are allowing for mobile vending and neighborhood retail and office uses to some degree within these areas. Community residential, again, your basic standard single-family lot. CR 6, 7, and 9, that conforms to our code as far as the 6,000, 7,000, 9,000 square foot lots. They are reducing the setbacks compared to our code, and we have a chart that shows that comparison. And this is in response largely to our desire to see more compact development, less opportunity for that backyard and barbecue here close to the airport. They'll have the opportunity to fill up their lots more with the structures, and again rely on that community open space to meet most of those needs. And so we understand where they're going. We've had a little bit of concern if everybody builds out at the maximum allowable, and you have rows of houses that are 8 feet apart, mm-hmm. that becomes a little bit monotonous again. So we've been talking about design standards that can work with that to make sure we still have that quality of development that we're looking for, and not everything is built at those maximums all the way down the street. Similarly, on the small lot, single-family residential, if they implement this particular land use group, they'd be able to do the 4.5 or the 4,500 square foot lot by right. To go below that, there's certain design standards they have to meet, just as are established in our zoning ordinance. And again, they've got their setbacks they're proposing, which are lesser setbacks than what we have within our code, will allow for a more compact development than we would ordinarily allow within these districts. Within the multifamily residential group, it's very similar. Again, they've used our code. They're pretty similar to our RM4 multifamily residents. Their main difference is they're allowing for a little bit of extra height, which we have no problem with, the extra height for those structures out here. They're also then providing...
And that fits in with the airport guidelines also?
Yeah, they'll obviously have to meet FAA requirements also, but where they're located, there shouldn't be any issues.
Okay.
They have some design standards, again, concepts they're working at within the residential areas, talking about their neighborhood scale layout, the compact block links, getting to that more urban-type block links, uncomplicated neighborhoods, street designs, looking a little bit narrower cross-section where they can, and shorter block links, trying to promote that slower vehicle speeds, that more pedestrian-type
atmosphere. Limited cul-de-sacs?
Here's the latest drawing we have for what a neighborhood might look like.
And an improvement.
The cul-de-sacs where they are used largely to help people get to the trails and open space system. And so they seem like they're being used logically in that regard. One of their concepts is an uncomplicated street system. I'm not sure they've reached that one in my mind. This appears to me to be a little bit complicated. It could have more direct connections. But they are oriented the lots towards the open spaces and parks and those types of things, and do have those pedestrian connections through those. And another example down, this would be the corner at Williams Field and Crisman. I've seen this one before. They've modified it a little bit, showing an example of how the residential could then connect in with the commercial on the corner without having to go out to the section line road, both by the pedestrian and by the vehicle. And then, again, within their design concepts, the residential amenities and the parks located throughout the area and the connections to the community center and so forth. That's the residential side. Any other questions or comments on the residential land use groups or going to commercial? In the commercial side, they've got... two that they're proposing. The community commercial is the primary one. It's modeled after our former C2, now LC, limited commercial zone. Very similar in uses and setbacks and other development standards. Again, they're allowing for a little bit more height than we have within our code is one of the primary differences, and some other reduced setbacks. The CMU is their other one. That's a mixed use modeled after our MX district. It's essentially the same as our MX district. Very few changes. Again, they're allowing for a little bit more height than we did in our code, and some other reduced setbacks. Give us a couple of concepts, or a concept here of how that Ray and Ellsworth Road could be developed using their standards. We have a concern that this still looks very suburban in its format, and they're working on some alternates to this. This corner of Ray and Ellsworth should blend with the other rest of that urban core that we're looking at for this area. And then the way that goes into the multifamily and the residential.
Have we talked, I don't know, on the north side of Ray is DMB, right?
Correct.
Have there been coordination or talk about what's going on north side of Ray or the
west side of Ellsworth.
The applicants can talk a little bit more about how they have actually been talking to DMB. There have been discussions about that. You know, we've got their development unit ideas for that, but they haven't really gone forward at this point with very much specificity. DMB has not on what they're specifically planning for.
I mean, what I'm saying is maybe not exactly what's going there, but if you look at the design scheme, and I know that's a flood control channel right there.
That's another complicating factor here. You got both the road and the flood channel that will separate the two.
Right. So, you know, there's a visual break there. But what I'm talking about is if we're looking at the west side of Ellsworth, and that's basically airport property, right?
Down here is, then the north side is private property.
So, and is that developable airport property? I forget how far down we go.
No. Mayor,
it is. I believe it is.
Pecos, yeah. Retention basin.
Well, it's a retention basin right now. You know, other than the flood control, is that going to? Well, because we're Clarpert Ray, so right. That's all developable. I think when you look at it, you got parking lots, and you're right, a very suburban look on this property. The question is it what's going to happen on the other three corners? Are those going to be more of an? Are we pushing for more of an urban intense type of thing, which would? Or because that would sort of look like it would be conflict if you have a suburban approach on one side and urban on one side, and then, you know, now you don't get consistency with, right, with the development. That's all I'm saying. It's not the specific building. It's the massing as it relates to the street. Would we like the buildings closer to the street, parking away? Is that what we're going to push for in all four corners? I think we need to look at how the four corners are going to sort of blend without if we're looking at the guidance that Harvard has as to how to approach the massing of the buildings on this site. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
And in this aerial view also of that same corner and how it may look. One thing I meant to mention earlier and forgot to mention is that the phasing is to start in kind of that northeast corner of DU2, the residential DU that's east of here. And so this, their only access at this point will be from Ellsworth. And so this road that comes in off of Ellsworth at this point will be that main access drive into the development for some period of time until Williamsfield and Crisman get built and other opportunities happen. And so they're having to look at that and how they balance that in terms of their immediate needs to access the residential development and the future development that will occur here in terms of the commercial. Again, back just very briefly on the infrastructure, the master plans have been submitted, reviewed, and approved. They're planning to follow most of the engineering standards. There are a few that are still working there with them on in terms of the right-of-way, width of those right-of-ways, and using the PUFEs and so forth, trying to overcome some of the issues we've had with the DMB project so we don't repeat those same things. And they're reserving the right to ask for other modifications as they go forward with the development. And so that's it. You've provided me some feedback on most of these items as we've gone. But if you have any other comments, particularly about the mix of uses, the development form, and the level of review as far as what would come back to council, P&Z, or staff, those are the primary things we were looking for any feedback you might have today.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Councilmember Higgins, Vice Mayor?
Just one question, Mayor. When you talked about the commercial development, are you really not hoping to see that last couple slides you saw?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
Oh, I was saying the last couple slides we saw, the commercial development?
Yeah.
Are you hoping that it doesn't end up looking like that?
No, what I'd like is some consistency in the area. For example, if you look at that area, the buildings are located away from the corner and there's parking and open space. And that would be fine for a suburban type thing, but if there are other corners, and if we're looking for more of an urban look, then all I would say is that the use is the same, but perhaps the buildings push more toward the street, more toward the corner to give it more massing along the street. That's what I'm looking at, is it building placement and massing and being consistent along the four corners.
Because I agree with the things you mentioned earlier. I agree with you, Mayor.
Yeah, and I get it that in the past, thank you.
Okay, let's all pause.
Do we want to note this as a special event or something? I get it that as I say that, you know, the hair goes back on the back of the developer's head because we've tried the building in front, parking in back approach, and that has generally not proven to be successful because we really didn't do it right. We have examples here in Mesa. I can think of some examples in Scottsdale and Tempe where they tried that, and we just didn't do it right. And so I'm not talking about the old way that was done back in the 80s and early 90s. You look at here in Mesa, for example, Guadalupe and Alma School, the southeast corner, I think, is done like that. Or you look up at McDowell and Hayden in Scottsdale, or even University and Rural in Tempe, where you had massing and parking in the back, and it just didn't seem to work. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, though, just how we have the buildings look at it more, maybe like a Tempe Marketplace, for example, which is done better and is a good mix. Something that has more of an urban type of a look, but recognizing that we can't force this isn't the center of downtown Phoenix, but it is going to develop over the years because of the airport. It's going to be more urban in nature. And so rather than just, you know, throw in the towel and just go to a traditional suburban look, I'd like to be as creative as we can to create that kind of urban footprint while still recognizing the suburban realities.
Mayor and Mayor Council and John, I think it's important for, as this discussion is taking place, that both P&Z and the council consider, at least look at the concepts that the airport has put out there for that first five-year design of the commercial development on the east side where the terminals go, because that dynamic may be important too.
That's what I'm looking at. Is I don't think we can look at this as being an island, because there's going to be high intensity development throughout this area, and I don't know what DMB has specific plan, but they do have some general ideas. But the thing that's going to really drive this is the fact that right on the other side of Ellsworth, on the west side of Ellsworth, you're going to have an airport terminal and the high intensity development that goes with airport terminal operations. And you know, I think that needs to flow naturally from that high intensity development to whatever is on the other side. And, you know, you can't be the same, but on the other hand, there needs to be a consistency. It needs to look like it was all thought out, rather than oops, you know, we have high intensity and then this looks like we're out on the edge of the city. And that's the reality of how this is going to develop. It's hard to think of that right now because you go by there and it's nothing but empty desert. But when you look at those plans and you look at what is not only envisioned, but we're actually in the specific planning area.
Oh, infrastructure and planning.
For infrastructure and for that terminal. That's going to happen in less than 10 years. Maybe there in 5 years. So that's not that far away. I think we need to – I'd like the developer to look really at what's going on there and see how that impacts their thought process on that corner.
And Mayor, coming up with a couple of the design concepts for this area that we'll see.
Now, I don't think it has a whole lot of impact once you get inside, because that's, you know, that is, then you can quickly transition type of residential, but at least right there on the Ontario. Vice Mayor, got a comment?
On that, I just heard Chris mention we're looking at some design concepts in the area. What was he referring to? Are you referring to the airport or the area in general?
I was specifically referring to that, the plans we just saw that the airport put out.
Yeah,
with the development around the
on the west side terminal. West side of Ellsworth and south of Ray.
Perfect. No, I think Mr. Brady, you made a good point. And what we probably need to do, given the mayor's comments, is work with the airport to take what they have done and add some pictures to it, so people can see the story and what we envision and how this is going to develop. Because right now, I believe that plan is more like a site plan map than it is a three-dimensional story about what kind of buildings you could see, what styles you might see, the activity. So you know, the more information we can put together, the more of a picture we can draw for people, and the better we can get that out to future residents and businesses, the easier this transition will be over the next 30 years.
Yeah, and to the Vice Mayor's point, I mean, I can see the developer now just cringing when we're talking about telling him how to develop. No, what we want to do is I want to maximize their development. I think they maximize it by coordinating with what's going on at the airport. I think that if they really look at that, and they have more opportunities if they really play off of that. And that's where you get the win-win. This isn't about restricting what they can do. This is about opening up and saying, hey, listen, there's a huge upside you have here. There's going to be a massive public investment that's taking a very, very intense form right across the street from you. You know, why don't you try and play off that and maybe see what you can do to coordinate with that better.
Agreed.
Does that make you feel better, Mr. Gilbert?
I would.
Okay.
Thank you, I do.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Mayor,
yeah,
and one more comment. I agree with that, but I think the residential will develop a little faster. We would expect the commercial space, and particularly the industrial space to the south, to build up over the next 30 years, really. That's a more long-term vision. So.
Right. Yeah, what we do in the next 5 years is really going to go a long way to determine how that plays out over 30 years. And I think that's the one thing that's hard for people to grasp is that this is now. This is not, when we came into this, you look 20, 30 years ago and you say, wow, that's out forever. But you know, if you looked at what the airport threw out and the fact that we're almost maxing out, we will be close to maxing out in not too long with the west side terminal, which means we got to move to the east side. Once we move to the east side, you know, the world changes real quickly. And that literally is going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years. So that's not that long. That's not that far away. So, okay.
One final comment, Mayor, is the Pacific Proving has put together a summary of their plan that we'll be passing out to council.
Good.
Here.
Great, thank you. Okay, any other questions or comments? Thank you. Looks exciting. Okay, the next item is to discuss and provide direction on a proposed Mesa City charter change, which is primarily as two proposals from the Chamber of Commerce. And before we get in here, and would like to invite Chamber of Commerce, Chamber President Otto Schilt. Otto, you want to come on up? The Chamber, several months ago, started discussing, I guess, some ideas as far as some charter changes. This has gone through their committees, their board. This was done independent of the city or the city council. And that's good that you have citizens that are willing to think about some things that they believe need to be or can be changed and are looking for ways to do things. Now, they have approached the council with proposals to put these before voters, these changes to the city charter. The chamber could have taken these directly to the voters by getting signatures and put them on the ballot. They chose the route of coming to the council and asking if we would put them on the ballot on their behalf. And we said we would certainly consider that. So I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Otto Schill, who can sort of give a background and maybe explain a little bit about the thought process that the chamber went through in arriving at this.
Thank you, Mayor, Council members. Several months ago, we were approached by a number of citizens who were concerned about the level of pay that you folks receive. And in response to those concerns, well, and there was a suggestion that we should do something about that. So in response to those concerns, we went to our board of directors and got input. The board of directors thought it was something that we should weigh into. So we gathered a small subcommittee, and that subcommittee concluded that any kind of proposal would have four important components. First of all, we rejected the idea that we should pick a number. We didn't think that was appropriate. So we thought that the four components would be an appropriate process for determining elected officials' compensation. It would include certain expectations, performance expectations, if you will. It would include a plan and a report on progress on the plan, and it would include some succession changes to the charter. We took those four elements back to our board. The board concluded they wanted the subcommittee to proceed with all four issues, and so that's the genesis of the proposal that we've submitted to you. We became aware during our process that you folks were dealing with the succession issue, so we pulled that out of ours. We didn't need to do that twice. So what you have before you is the thinking of the business community. It's gone through several edits and a number of comments. And and we've taken the final language through our board, and that's the proposal you have before you. So,
okay. Thank you. So there's basically two separate proposals, or it worked out to be two. I'm going to say separate. I know that they're really combined, but they are come out as two separate proposed charter changes because they involve different sections. The first one involves what you would call, I guess on the agenda we talk about establishing an independent commission on compensation. Mm-hmm. Second one is the a definition of refining the responsibilities or expanding, or but certainly at least defining the responsibilities of the mayor.
Yeah, I'd probably couch those as expectations.
Expectations.
We specifically tried to stay away from language that was mandatory or that might cause problems that way. But we did think that an independent commission was the right way to determine compensation.
Where did you come up with that idea?
We looked at a number of communities across the country do. We surveyed different communities and how they address these kinds of issues, and that's where our proposal came from.
And when you looked at those communities, what was your findings as far as whether – I mean, it seems like since you adopted it that there's been some success in this approach. Is that what you found?
I think so. I think that it's a more open process. We went through a couple of iterations about how the council got or how the commission would be appointed or developed and how many would be on it, where they would come from. And essentially we've settled with this particular iteration, and it's similar to what other communities do. And again, for us, I realize that for whatever reason the council has divided it into two pieces. For us, it's kind of a unified approach.
Right. I think we divided it because since they do deal with different sections of the charter, it was easier to. They're really somewhat separate issues. Deb, Ms. Spinner, was that your thought?
Yes, Mayor. That as well as they're not legally tied to one another, so right. The voters could adopt one and. You know, could wish to adopt one provision and not the other, or so they didn't have to go up or down together. So for terms of writing the ballot, we thought it was best to go with two.
Well, and I would say to your other point, we thought that coming to the council with these proposals was a better approach than running a campaign and then, you know, running into issues like that one. So this is a more collaborative process, and we think that was appropriate. So.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Schill? Councilman Kavanaugh.
Maybe not questions, but more comments. I appreciate the work that the chamber, as a chamber member, I appreciate the work that you've done to highlight the issues, the role of the mayor and council in economic development, and as well as the salary issues. With regard to the salary issues, I think the proposal that you're presenting is an interesting one. I think it's one that could be adopted by voters either as part of a charter change or, I think, approved by council as part of an ordinance under the authority in the charter for the council to set council pay. Am I correct, Ms. Winner?
Yes. Under the charter, the council can adopt an ordinance to adjust the salaries of the council.
And to continue, with regard to salary issues, it's interesting the framers of the charter anticipated that the council, I think, regularly or periodically would look at mayor and council pay. But sadly, the reality is, since 1967, I think there's only been two changes or modifications to the pay. I was part of one of those councils back in the late 90s, 1999, 2000, where we did approve an increase in pay. It didn't cause a big stir in the community. People didn't want our heads on a pike, and they didn't want to recall us for that reason. So
they had plenty of other reasons.
But I think in the behavior of elected officials, there's always a reluctance to take on the salary issue. And I think what you've identified certainly is a newer trend in communities across the country to engage citizens in the community in a body. To review the salary question and to make recommendations based on research. I think it brings the issue much more in the open and creates a more transparent process. In another lifetime, when I worked at Legislative Council, I worked with the State Salary Commission on doing those issues. And I think what you're suggesting is certainly a positive approach for the council to consider. The other proposal on the issue of setting the goals and expectations for the mayor and council, I guess I would approach it just in a little different way. I think certainly what we've done as a council in recent years is we've been very good at coming together to discuss what our goals and expectations are and work plans are for every year. And I think many of the ideas that you raise, the expectations that you suggest, I think are certainly worthy of full discussion by the council and consideration as we come together in our annual retreat every year, setting out our work plan and goals for the mayor to work on, for the council to work on. So I think with regard to that aspect of the proposal, I think I would be more in favorable of incorporating those ideas and suggestions and expectation in terms of discussion that we do as a council periodically, or at least every year. The Salary Commission one, I think, is certainly worthy of further discussion and consideration by the council, and perhaps by ordinance rather than charter change. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments for?
Well, if I could make a comment on, to your point, Councilman Kavanaugh. First of all, we hope you see that the substance of what we've done is born out of the example you folks have set. Your ability to work with staff and work together has made an important difference to the city of Mesa. We're also concerned about economic development in the city of Mesa and making sure that Mesa is moving forward and developing in that way, in a proper way. And so you can see that thread running throughout the proposal. One of the issues in the beginning was, do we try to hurry up and do something for this election cycle? Not sure that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but we do think that the issues are tied together and important and should be considered. So we brought this proposal to you and encourage you to consider them.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? I'd sort of like to echo what Councilmember Kavanaugh talked about. It's always awkward when council members talk about salary, because you think there's more consternation out there than there really is. It's just an awkward situation. I really like the idea that you've proposed, simply because I think it makes it a much more transparent process. It opens it up to the public, and it brings some, excuse me, although there's politics involved in everything, it certainly starts it out and from the citizen standpoint makes it a very reasonable and rational process, rather than from the day one the politics and the political realities set in. And I think that's healthy.
In addition to being similar to what some other communities have done, it's similar to the business community. It's not unlike what the nonprofit community does. It's, it comes from a number of places.
Exactly. And what's interesting is that before I knew you were working on this, we had a sister cities visit from Burnaby, British Columbia, one of our sister cities. And Mayor Corrigan was talking to me, and he had heard about the discussion that was going on in the community, and just unsolicited, we were talking about various things and various approaches, and he went into this salary citizen salary commission that Burnaby uses, and explained to me, and it's a very, very similar process to what you have. I mean, it was funny because as he laid it out for me, and then literally a week later, I heard not from you but from others sort of what was going on. And I remember we approached you and I said, I hear you're looking at this, and it almost matched exactly what Burnaby had done. They've had very good success, he said, since they, I can't remember, it's been in the last 10 years since they moved to that. And he said it's been the best thing that ever happened to them, because it really brought things out in the open. It no longer was the dirty little secret nobody wanted to talk about. And it really put it on a rational basis. And he said it's been very well accepted, very well by the community and the council, too, because it really did bring some real data, real comparisons, and made it real world rather than purely a political issue. So I really like that. I'm also enamored by the idea that I was a little troubled as far as the charter. You know, the charter already grants not only the right, but really the responsibility of the council to set the salaries, because at the end of the day, it's sort of a budget issue, and the council has the ultimate authority, and I don't think we can defer that. Whether we I would love to be able to say, here, go do it, don't make me deal with that, but that's not reality. I think at the end of the day, the council, our responsibility is to determine these things. But I like the idea that the mechanism that would be used is something that is separate, independent, and transparent. And then you give it to the council as a, here's what we found, and you accept the recommendation. I like that process. I also, though, wonder, and I've wondered since I first heard this, whether this needs to be embedded, whether specific procedures need to be embedded in the charter, or whether the right and the authority and the responsibility, which is already there, is what stays in the charter, and this could be more of a mechanism or a procedure that could be done through ordinance. And so I'm enamored with the idea that rather than a charter amendment, which once you put it in the charter, you know, the good thing is it's in the charter now. The bad thing is that let's say we get in 3, 4, 5 years into this, and it just doesn't work as well as we thought. We're sort of stuck with it. And if it's an ordinance, you can tweak it, you can adjust it, you can fix things that aren't there. And if it's a charter, that's a serious thing, because now you've got to go back to the voters. And with this big of a change, I think I'm a little bit more interested in the ordinance approach, simply because I think it gives us the flexibility to tweak if we need to down the road and make it work even better without going through the whole process. And I think the end result is virtually the same. You know, through ordinance, voters still have their say. There still is a check and balance on actions taken by council, even this. So I like the idea of it by ordinance as opposed to that. As far as the first thing, I appreciate the fact that you've looked at what this council's done and you said, if I'm hearing you right, you like the approach that we've taken. I really do appreciate that, because I will tell you, this group has worked hard to try and accomplish that. We started literally before we took office and tried to decide on a tone and an objective and a vision. And I would say it's been a pleasure working with this group, for me, working with this group, this council. We don't always agree on specifics, but we've always been in unison about where we want to go. And not all councils are like that. I look at cities around us, and you see councils that don't seem to be headed in the same direction. And this council has always, I believe, done that. They've put aside their differences when we talked about where we were headed. You know, we disagreed on how to get there, which is healthy and it's good. But we're unique. I mean, this group has a personality. It's made up by the individual personalities of each of the members of the council. And I'm not sure that I want to take how we do things. I'm struggling with putting in even if it's aspirational, putting in writing something that may or may not fit the personality of our successors. They may choose a different route, may end up in the same place, but they may want to do things a little differently. And so I'm struggling a bit with not the concept, but with whether that's the best way to accomplish it. But I take it as a compliment, the fact that you have come up with an idea that you think hopefully puts in the good things we've done and has sort of ignored all of our screw-ups. Thank you very much for that. But has put in place some of the good things. I'm just a little bit, I need to think about it a little bit longer, and I don't know whether we have the time to do that. And I'm a little bit reluctant to move ahead with something that I think merits further discussion. And, you know, we're under a very strict time deadline as it relates to the charter amendment. I mean, Debbie, we basically have to do something next Monday, don't we, if we're going
to
get
for something. Charter amendments, yeah. The ordinance would have to be introduced on Monday and adopted on the 9th,
yeah,
in order to make the ballot.
Okay.
Well, as I say, timing was one issue that was part of the discussion. So, you know, obviously you have our proposal that we think,
right,
is important. If, you know, it's, I think it's up to you how you go forward with it.
Okay. Councilman Fender.
I was going to say, one of the, with your comments just now, Mayor, the point that really stands out to me and what I appreciate is if you approach it from an ordinance standpoint, that it allows that check and balance in the system. And it still gives the opportunity for citizens to be actively involved if they disagree or have those. And trying to, you know, unwind a charter amendment that, you know, could take years and things. So I think that's a smarter way to go with that portion of the approach. And I was going to add to your comments, agree with what you've said. And I look at it reflecting on the, and you know, everything that's occurred. There's so many successes that are happening. And I attribute, you know, we have a wonderful city manager with all his economic development backgrounds, and then staff that's involved, the boards and committees, and truly the citizens. And so, fortunately, things are going so well, and we're having such a positive impact in the community. And I don't know how you ever, you know, replicate or duplicate that in the future. But I do appreciate the chamber and their involvement and their goals and desires to make sure that we were able to do these same positive things for decades in the future. So what's the best way to accomplish that? I don't know. And I think there's, you know, opportunities for future discussion. But I do appreciate what the chamber's doing and to step up and be able to say, hey, we like what we see. This community is so much farther ahead. And even through these worst of times, we've had tremendous success. So how do we take that into the future and keep this wonderful thing going? So thank you for doing that. And so I look forward to more discussion down the road.
So I've heard three of us talk about the compensation issue, at least as an ordinance, moving forward. Councilman Glover, and Councilman Glover is nodding, so that's four of us. So Debbie, why don't we move forward with that as an ordinance rather as a charter change? Is that okay?
We can. I guess I would have a question for the council, because we will be establishing this as a board or commission under Section 501 of the Charter, which you can do by ordinance. The only thing I'm seeing that conflicts here that I don't think is significant, but I want you to know, is the Charter says that these members will be appointed for a three-year staggered term. The current amendment says four-year staggered term, so the terms would have to change. Otherwise, the ordinance can stay as is. One question that I've been talking to the city clerk about is the publication, whether we can actually move forward on Monday, because we had to publish it before introduction, because we have back-to-back and we have to publish it 6 days in advance. So I need to know, talk to the city clerk about whether we need to republish it, and if we do, then it may not be able to come back until August.
Okay.
For consideration.
All right. Well, that's
but
Mayor.
Other than that, yes, we can absolutely do basically just what's in here.
Okay, but with that one change to conform with 501.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Vice Mayor?
Yeah. Debbie, if we have to bring it back in August, are we going to be able to get it on the ballot
well,
in November?
Vice Mayor, it will not have to go on the ballot because you are establishing a board under Section 501, so it's just established by ordinance. It does not have to go to the voters.
Yeah. So if I could
okay.
What we're doing is that we're accomplishing the same thing. We're leaving in place, what is it, Section 202 of the Charter?
Yes, Mayor.
Which basically states that the council establishes the salaries. What we're doing is establishing a commission to create the procedure, the mechanism by which we establish those salaries.
That's correct.
I just didn't know if we needed to have a charter change to do that.
No.
Trying to put together.
Okay.
No.
And I think what I'm hearing from the other one is that it merits more discussion, and probably what we need to do is bring it back and maybe work a little bit more with the chamber. And when we get back in August, talk a little bit more about how we might define those and adopt those in a different way. Is that what I'm hearing?
And we'd be happy to participate in that discussion.
I would love to have you participate. Once again, we really appreciate the chamber taking these issues. And we didn't ask you to do it, and that's great when citizens feel strongly enough about how their government works to come up with some solid proposals to improve it in their mind.
I think you got a letter even from one of them. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he came.
I've gotten several letters. I mean, when this issue first came up, I think it was, last August, September?
A while ago, yeah.
Yeah, and there was even a newspaper article. I got several letters. So I know it's an issue of interest out there. I had several people walk up, and they were unaware of the elected officials' compensation issue. And so, you know, I got mostly positive things, and I said, hey, you know, I'm not going to touch that. And the chamber grabbed hold of it, and you heard the same thing. So I really appreciate you coming up with what I think is a very, very solid proposal. And so let's check into that, see. And if we can't, then let's maybe introduce in July, and we'll come up for a final, because I know we can introduce on the 9th.
Yes. And if the council's comfortable, if I look at the publication and we're okay, we will introduce on the 2nd.
For the 9th, yeah, on the second one, because I don't know that there's any major changes except for, I think you've got feedback from individual council members on specific provisions related to that. So,
Okay? Yes.
Thank you very much, Otto.
Thanks very much.
And please convey to your board and everyone our appreciation for all they do and for their, and also to Peter, to best wishes. I hear he's doing better and maybe even is he able to come back and perform some duties or?
Well, we're trying to understand what that looks like. Okay. He got a good report last week.
Good.
So we're trying to figure out what that looks like and what.
Well,
what
best
can do.
Wishes to Peter and to Megan and to everybody, and thanks so much to the chamber. We have I'm finding out we have a unique relationship with our chamber, one that's evolved quite a bit over the last couple years and has been very, very healthy. And when I say unique, you know, we truly do look at each other as partners in advancing the community and in a way that other chambers and city councils I think don't look at it. And I think it's not something we set out to do to be different, but it's just sort of evolved naturally that way. And with your leadership and Peter's leadership and the board, I really appreciate what has been accomplished and look forward to good things in the future.
Thank you,
Mayor. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Reports on meetings or conferences attended. Mr. Cavanaugh, you need to report on a big thing in your district.
Well, we had groundbreaking for the Fiesta substation for the police department. It was very well attended and getting very positive feedback from certainly residents in my district who are excited about the new investment in the Fiesta district. And so I just want to extend my thanks to all the city staff that worked so hard to move that project to this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? I'd like to recognize last night a few of us attended the Maricopa Association of Governments, or MAG, Desert Peaks Awards, and City of Mesa was a recipient in one major award.
We're going to present those on Monday.
Oh, we are going to present those. Then I'll wait till Monday. But we
won some awards.
We had a good thing recognized on by the region, so I'll wait till Monday before we get into that. Okay?
Mayor?
Yes, Vice Mayor.
I will mention one thing. Yesterday afternoon, rather, I attended a going-away party for Marquisha Griffin. Marquisha was my assistant for several years, and she moved up to economic development, and now she is leaving the city to take advantage of some new opportunities, and I want to wish her well.
Great. Thank you. And this morning we attended the retirement of Mr. Willie Black, who's in the background.
Willie,
there.
Come here. Come on up.
Come on up, Willie. Going to brag a little bit about our solid waste. And, you know, that sounds not like too much of an exciting thing to do, but I will tell you, I go around the state, and I have been cornered and approached many times with people who rave about our solid waste operations. And basically, it is almost it's almost a given that our solid waste operations in our division are considered to be the leaders in the state, the best in the state, and that is no small accomplishment. That for others to look at how we do things and try to use it as a model and try to emulate what Mesa does, I think, is a real recognition of what you and your team has been able to accomplish. And Willie is leaving us now, going on to the better world of retirement. So thank you so very much for all you've done. And
30 years of service.
30 years of service. Wow.
Pete, we're going to miss this. I was mentioning this morning, we're going to miss his budget forecasting. As you know, Willie's been known to come before council and talk about his views of the economy based upon tonnage and
tonnage of garbage
and barrels out on the curb. So we're going to miss that.
And you know what? We found that he's been right more than most economists have.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It used to be we could do that with water hookups, but you know this recession sort of screwed that up with all the foreclosure. We found that out. But garbage is always dependable.
Correct. Mayor and council members, I just want to thank you for it's been an honor and a privilege to serve the citizens of Mesa. And garbage will never let you down. And I've been fortunate to work with a great staff, and I can't take credit for the department. It's the people that I'm fortunate enough to work with, and they make it happen every day. And we had a breakfast this morning for them, actually to thank them for everything they do for us. And I appreciate my time with Mesa. It's been great. No regrets. This has been a great place to work. I can tell you, this is my third city manager, and it's by a long shot been the best city manager. The other two were good, but I think Chris has done a great job.
Thank you all.
Collectively, the mayor and council, there's been some good mayors, some good council members, but collectively, this is the best. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your support over the years. It makes my job so much easier, and thank you.
Yeah, this guy knows how to go out on top, doesn't
he?
Yeah,
he does. Good.
We like that. Well, thank you so very much because, you know, it's always nice to have people say good things about your city and your operations. And we hear a lot about a lot of our departments, but our solid waste really stands out and stands heads and shoulders above others. And it's the one, when Willie comes and talks to us, it's the one time that when people come up to you and said, hey, that discussion today in council was pure garbage, but it's actually true. It's actually true. So thank you. Thank you, Willie. And
thank
good
you.
Luck. Good luck in all you do. We really appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Willie.
Ms. Carger, do we have any requests to speak from the public?
No requests, Mayor.
All right.
Mayor, just quickly.
Yes. Mr. Brady, yeah. Go ahead.
Just a few items. There will be a public safety committee meeting Monday, July 2nd at 3:30, and then that will be followed by a council study session and then the council meeting. I think we're starting now at 4:45. Check your packets for that time. And also this weekend, our Celebration of Freedom, another great free event, Friday and Saturday, starting at 6, going till 10, downtown Mesa. Lots of fun, food, music, car shows, motorcycles, and of course, fireworks on Saturday. So invite everybody to come downtown to enjoy that. We've turned the temperature down from 118, so it should be bearable. And then
it was bearable at 118.
That's what I'm saying. So it should be just a pleasant joy at 112.
Walk in the park.
And then just last night, watching the Olympic trials, Mesa's, and I'm not sure if I'm going to say her. I know her last name is Larson.
Is it Brijan or
Bria? Bria. B R E E J A.
I should know because she swam in Mountain View.
Went to Mountain View, won her the 100 meter breaststroke. So she'll be going to the London Olympics. So pretty cool, and it was one of the best. Swimmers in, hopefully she'll get some medals in London. So pretty exciting to see one of Mesa's own.
And I apologize. There's a great story, and I had his name written down, and I left it out in the car. The 11-year-old Mesa
on the
X Games tonight.
Yes.
I'm feeling horrible about that because I don't have his name right with me.
But we may want to, the Olympics are coming up in the middle of July. We may want to do some kind of resolution or something maybe on July 9th. Wishing her well. So, anyway, just thought I'd bring
that
up.
Hold on just one quick second.
Or do you have
I've got it. I'm pulling it up right now. Come on. Jagger Eaton, 11 years old, going to participate in the X Games tonight, I believe, this afternoon or tonight, on the, that incredible ramp that they do, which I can't even look at without getting scared. And this, he gets up into the youngest, I think, ever to participate. So great day for Mesa individuals in sports, and thanks for bringing that up. Appreciate that. Okay. Have a motion to enter an executive session for Councilman Finter, second Councilman Kavanaugh. All in favor say aye. We will be entering an executive session. Thank you.